On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Antidepressants are a multi-billion dollar business in this country and around the world. And therein, says psychotherapist Gary Greenberg, lies a big problem. Pharmaceutical companies and researchers are casting their nets too wide to find new patients, calling normal, rational feelings a disease. Some simple sadness, the occasional melancholy, is part of normal life, he says, and getting rid of them may mean getting rid of the soul. Up next, On Point, manufacturing depression and the economy of melancholy. Joining me now from Seattle, Washington, is Gary Greenberg. He is a practicing psychotherapist and a freelance writer. His article about his experience as a test patient appears in the May issue of Harper's Magazine. Gary, thanks for being here.
Hi, Jane.
So tell us your story. You volunteer for this clinical study about depression. Did you think you were depressed?
Well, I thought I would meet the criteria for the study that I went to sign up for, which was a study of minor depression. I didn't.
What did the clinician tell you?
The clinician told me that I scored too high on something called the Hamilton Depression Rating Scale to be considered minorly depressed, and that, in fact, I was majorly depressed.
And did that surprise you?
Yeah, I was a little taken aback. I thought I'd come in there with sort of a pedestrian case of living in the modern world, and turned out that I had major depression.
So what was your demeanor then during the questioning? Were you tearful? Were you complaining? Were you melancholy? Were you honest?
I was doing about the normal amount of whining, you know, about life being difficult and not being as happy as I'd like to be. I wasn't tearful. I wasn't abject. I was certainly honest.
Mm-hmm. Was it possible you were depressed and it was obvious to everybody but you?
Well, I don't think there's any question that I was depressed. I mean, the guy asked the right questions, and I gave him the answers that were honest, and I turned up on the scale depressed. So by definition, I was depressed.
But just not majorly depressed, not a major clinical depression.
No, apparently I was majorly depressed. That's what I turned up as. Now, did I agree with that? Did I think that somehow that corresponded with my sense of myself and reality? No. But on the other hand, who was I to say the label belongs to the doctors, not the patients.
So did they know you were a psychotherapist?
And
they,
a writer.
And a writer, and that you were well
aware. And that I was writing about what we were talking about.
Mm-hmm. And that you were well aware of this sort of checklist of symptoms for depression.
Oh, sure. Well, we didn't talk about that specifically, but I assume that they assumed that I knew.
Mm-hmm. So to be fair to those participating in the study, you say in the article that they were genuinely helpful to you. You say they were unfailingly kind. You say the doctor was not a bad person or disingenuous or a shill for the drug company. So what was going on?
Well, I mean, these are really well-intentioned people who are, some of them brilliant and all of them really smart, and they want to relieve suffering, and they're very motivated to do that. And the power that they have to do that is dependent on diagnosing people and in many respects in giving them medication or other forms of treatment for what ails them. And so what was going on was that they were conducting psychiatry as usual.
And so what were the options for your treatment given your diagnosis?
Well, I wasn't there to get treated. I was there to be in a clinical trial. And so the option was to take the experimental drug, which in the case of the trial that I ended up in, if I had been in the minor depression study, it would have been either Celexa or a placebo. I think that's right. And in the major depression study, I was going to be taking omega-3 fatty acids or placebo.
And so did you ultimately take the pills?
Yeah, I took the pills. I participated in the trial for 8 weeks. I took, I believe, 6 pills every day for 8 weeks.
And what happened?
Every 2 weeks, I'd go back up to Mass General, and we'd have a conversation. I would take the psychological tests again and fill out the forms. There was a number of written tests, what are called paper and pencil tests, And we'd chat briefly, and then I left.
So from your experience in your psychotherapy practice, what is the difference between the, quote, major depression that you were diagnosed with in this study and the major depression that you've seen firsthand in your patients?
Well, again, if you're just talking about major depression, the way it's defined by the psychiatric industry, I'm not sure we can make that distinction. I mean, you meet the criteria or you don't. Now, within those criteria, you can be more or less depressed. In my case, I believe I was diagnosed mild chronic major depression. But I also think that I've encountered people, as I'm sure every clinician and most everybody has, whose depression just lays them flat, who can't get out of bed, who aren't interested in much of anything, who have no experience except pain, for whom pleasure is just an additional burden. I don't know that I want to be in the business of saying that that's depression and the other thing isn't, but it is important. I think it's important to notice that that's not how I was.
So what was your takeaway then, Gary, from this experience? What was the lesson that you learned?
Well, what really interested me about this experience was learning about the way that our experience of unhappiness or melancholy gets medicalized and how that's a very interesting and two-sided phenomenon. On the one hand, there are some real benefits to medicalizing suffering. Patients can then make demands on the healthcare system for relief, whether it's drugs or therapy or just recognition of their pain, depending on what their pain is about. And that's a real benefit. I mean, it's a comment on the way healthcare is delivered in our society, but nonetheless, that's how we get taken care of. So having a diagnostic label is a very useful thing. Calling it a disease is a useful thing. On the other hand, the cost of medicalizing depression, at least in my experience, was that the study was interested in everything except my experience. The study was interested in how I was sleeping and whether or not I was, napping during the day and stuff like that. And the study was also interested in my experience to the extent that it could reduce it to a number on the Hamilton Depression Rating Scale. Was I feeling excessively self-critical? Was I feeling guilty? Which are interesting questions, but it's very difficult and I think ultimately impossible to reduce those things to a number. So the cost of medicalizing depression is pretty high.
You say in your article that often depression is more like an ideology rather than an illness, more false consciousness than disease. In what way?
Well, actually, what I was saying there was that the way the doctor was presenting depression to me was he was saying that it can make it impossible for you to even know your own experience or your own history. And so sometimes what I meant by that is sometimes what doctors do, and I'm sure I'm guilty of this in my own therapy practice, is saying that I know your experience better than you do. And the reason you don't know your experience is because you're pathological, you're sick. That's another cost of medicalizing people's experience.
You talk about, along those lines, about how a clinician can reshape a patient in a way that makes them a good fit for a drug, for an antidepressant in this case. Is that right?
Well, I think you go to your doctor and you tell your doctor what the problem is, whether he's your family doc or your psychiatrist, and he says to you, well, you're depressed, and here's how I know you're depressed. You're not sleeping. You've lost interest in your usual activities, and here's something that might help you in, let's say, a drug. And you take the drug, and so now what you're looking for are the things that the doctor told you signaled your depression to him in the first place, or her. You're looking to see whether you're sleeping better or feeling less anxious or less guilty. So you are almost, it's almost unavoidable that you'll start to see your own experience in the way that your doctor orders it for you. And I do think that what happens there is that you're sort of prepared for the drugs. And that doesn't just happen at the therapist's office. That happens in the media, particularly with the advertising for antidepressant drugs.
So how did the medicine change you then, Gary?
Well, I'm not sure the medicine changed me, except for that it made me wonder when I was feeling unhappy on a particular day or questioning what was going on in my life or whatever. It made me wonder, gee, I wonder if I really do have a disease here, you know, because I was in the middle of this process, and it's very compelling. You're in this huge, sophisticated hospital with these really nice, smart people, and they're pretty convinced that whatever's going on with you is a function of your brain chemistry. And, you know, it's pretty compelling. You start to think that way.
So bottom line for you, it's we're too quick to pop a pill at the slightest sign of sadness.
I don't think that's true.
No.
No, I don't think too quick. No, look, life is really hard. It'll drive you to your knees. Why do we want to say it's too hard? It's too easy for people to take drugs. I don't have any problem with people taking drugs. The question isn't whether people should take drugs for their unhappiness. The question is whether their unhappiness has to be medicalized for them to take drugs in the first place. Mm. I mean, that's something that we do in our society that has, again, benefits and disadvantages, costs. I think that the cost might be too high. It might be a much simpler thing to cut out the middleman and, you know, just say, well, here, this drug might make you feel better. Mm. But it generally in our society isn't enough to say, well, that's just going to make you feel better. In fact, that's the reason that we make certain drugs illegal. What we do is we say, well, you have an illness, and here's the cure. You have a chemical imbalance, and here's the thing that's going to put it right, which, scientifically speaking, simply doesn't hold water. That's just a myth.
We're going to get to some of the broader issues that your article, Gary, raises in just a few minutes. But first, since the heart of your story involves the clinical trials that you went through at Mass General here in Boston, I want to get some reaction from that institution. So joining me now is Dr. Jonathan Alpert from Boston. He is Associate Director of the Depression Research Program at the Massachusetts General Hospital and had a supervisory role over the study that Gary Greenberg participated in. He also teaches psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Alpert, great to have you with us. Thank you, sir.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jane.
So Mass General diagnosed Gary Greenberg with major depression. Did he have major depression?
Yes, I understand that he did. And it's important to understand how major depression is diagnosed, that over the years, based on the kinds of symptoms that people report, the kinds of symptoms that run in families, the kinds of symptoms that come up on future episodes of depression for somebody who has had recurrent episodes of depression. 9 different symptoms were distilled into what's sometimes referred to as the DSM-4 classification of diagnosis. And that's been a very useful classification both for clinical research and for informing clinical practice. And those symptoms that will be familiar to many listeners would include having depressed mood most of the day, most days, having loss of interest, having sleep disturbance, appetite disturbance, recurrent feelings of guilt, concentration problems, thoughts of suicide. Now, any one of us can have any of those experiences on any given day, or even for a few days in a row or during a difficult period of time. It turns out that very few people have those symptoms for sustained periods, even for weeks on end, where they could truthfully say, yes, I have that symptom, like loss of interest, depressed mood, poor concentration, sleep disturbance, day after day, most of the time, for even 2 weeks on end. And we find that about 15% of the population, sometime in their lifetime, experiences what is defined as major depression, which is defined as having 5 of those 9 symptoms continuously over at least 2 weeks. Usually by the time anyone seeks treatment, it's been going on for much, much longer than 2 weeks, but one needs to have it for at least 2 weeks.
So Gary Greenberg describes the sort of clinical trials that he was involved in as pseudoscience. Obviously, you would disagree. What actually goes on in a clinical trial, as he was describing in from his perspective? What's yours?
Right. I very much disagree, and I appreciate Gary's very thoughtful comments about the kind of care he received and the earnestness and and dedication of the clinical investigators that he worked with. I think what he's putting his finger on is the sense that it's highly reductionistic, that somehow this was an oversimplification of his experience. And it's very, very important to understand that everyone involved in the process understands the degree to which it is an oversimplification, that's sort of the essence of clinical research in general. If one does a study looking at myocardial infarction, for example, heart attacks, that's going to be a study that looks at, let's say, comparing 2 treatments for the management of heart attacks. it's going to include people, some of whom collapsed at work and other people who just had what they thought might be mild indigestion, but they all had EKG changes, changes on the electrocardiogram, enzyme changes that defined a heart attack in a certain way that it's currently defined. And the study will look at very simple measures like how many days did they spend in the hospital or how many times did they have chest pain over a period of several days. Everyone understands the experience of having a heart attack is much more complicated than that, and even the definition of a heart attack may change over years, but that kind of research actually produces very meaningful results. And we've found the same thing, we meaning psychiatric researchers around the world, have found the same thing in studying depression, that one can devise studies that are simple enough to test measurable hypotheses with very simple instruments and find meaningful results and try to advance our understanding and treatment of depression that much further, even though we understand that having 5 out of 9 symptoms of depression doesn't say anything about the richness of one's life and the complexity of one's experience.
Well, Dr. Alpert, can you advance this field or any field without the clinical research that we're talking about?
No, that's precisely it. That in Gary's article that will be coming out in Harper's, that enjoyed reading, he talks about the way in which psychoanalysis hasn't progressed as much as one would hope as a science. And as much as I respect psychoanalysis and very interested in it, I have to agree. And one of the central reasons for that is that it's been very, very difficult in that form of psychotherapy to devise research protocols that can advance the field as a treatment science in the way that other fields have been able to advance when they've been able to design clinical research studies. So the very reductionism that, you know, Gary, disparages or at least critiques is really necessary in order to make sense of the very complex data that every human being brings into clinical work and clinical trial.
Gary Greenberg, do you want to respond, please?
Well, I guess I don't want to be incendiary, but that's a little bit like saying you have to destroy the village in order to save it. I mean, the comparison between depression and myocardial infarction is a little bit far-fetched to me. And I think that's probably just a worldview difference between me and Dr. Alpert. I guess that's what it is. It seems to me that, yeah, the problem is in being reductionistic, and there is a certain amount of that that's unavoidable in any scientific research. And by the way, I don't think it's fair to say that this is pseudoscience at all. This isn't pseudoscience. This is science applied to something that science may not be able to get at. And I think that's a big difference. So when Dr. Alpert says that depression can be meaningfully compared to myocardial infarction, that's exactly, in my view, the problem. I mean, the question of whether or not you have you think you're having heartburn or arm pain or whatever is irrelevant to the fact of your heart attack. The heart attack, as he said, can be measured with EKGs and so on, and treated through some very, very direct and effective interventions. And that's a great thing to study with the scientific method. But is the experience of depression, is that somehow not important to the thing we call depression? Is the experience, our experience, just an epiphenomenon? And this is precisely the point that I'm trying to get at in my article.
Dr. Alpert, do you want to respond to that?
Yes. Well, I think, you know, earlier Gary was saying that the costs of medicalizing depression, or specifically talking about it as an illness and treating it as an illness, that the costs are very high. I would contend just the opposite, that the costs of not doing that are actually much higher. That is to say, both in terms of human suffering, in terms of risk of suicide, even in terms of productivity, that there's a reason why employers have increasingly implemented depression screening programs within their organizations, that it turns out that if you go ahead and vigorously screen for and treat people who are suffering with depression, that it's actually of benefit to employers. People work better, they work more effectively, get along with people better, or recognize that the work they're doing is not really what they wanted to do, and now they have enough self-confidence so that they go seek employment elsewhere. It's not only the pharmaceutical companies where you can say, well, obviously it's in their direct self-interest to market antidepressants and to convince most of us that we're suffering from depression and should take it. But even people like employers, where in a sense you would think their health care costs would go up if they treat depression, just the opposite happens, that actually they find that their health care costs go down, because when people are effectively treated who truly do have depression, again, we're talking about maybe 15% of the population over their lifetime experiencing depression. So most people at any given point don't have it. But the small number of people who do at any given point usually wind up not working better, using less in the way of healthcare resources, presenting to their primary care doctor less often with backaches, headaches, vague symptoms that turned out to be related to depression. And we get many more heartfelt letters of thanks from research participants who say, you know, my life was transformed. I wasn't even sure that this was depression. I just knew that I was chronically very, very unhappy, or had been very unhappy for the last year. And, you know, this really changed my life, made a very big difference. So I think the cost of not detecting that among people who are suffering and not actively trying to treat it are much higher than the risk of overcalling it or oversimplifying it.
Let's hear what our listeners have to say. Many are lined up to join the conversation. David is calling from Cambridge. David, you're on the line. Go ahead. Hello.
Hello, Jane.
Hi.
Well, full disclosure, I'm a psychiatrist, and I do agree that there are times and that there's the over-pharmacologicalization of treatment of depression. And there certainly is a lot in the literature to support, particularly cognitive therapy. Now, but the concerns I have with Mr. Greenberg are three. One, that he entered this study dishonestly, and he played some word games in describing whether he was depressed. He says he's a bit evasive and says, well, the test said I was depressed. And I think that's essentially dishonest. Secondly, I don't know what the law is in Washington State, but in Massachusetts, anyone without any degree can hang out a shingle that says psychotherapist. It's you don't even need to finish high school. So I don't know what the level of his training is. And thirdly, going back to the issue of what he calls these categories of symptoms, these kinds of symptoms are not just addressed in pharmacologic studies, but also in rigorous studies looking at the effects of certain kinds of psychotherapies, and most commonly cognitive behavioral therapy. So those are my concerns.
Thank you, David. Let's turn to Gary Greenberg. David says, thinks you were dishonest, played word games in this study. Your response?
Well, I'm not trying to play word games. I think that in some ways the diagnostic criteria, they're all in language, and you're sort of forced to address the question of are you depressed from the standpoint of, well, do I meet the criteria? Obviously, I met the criteria. I do want to respond also. I have a PhD in clinical psychology. I've been published in the academic as well as the popular press, and I'm licensed in the state of Connecticut, which is where I practice. I just happen to be in Washington right now.
Let's go to Robert. You want to finish? Go ahead.
Yeah, I do. I want to just say that I think it's important to understand that I'm not against treating depression or unhappiness with drugs, antidepressant drugs, or any other kind of drugs that work. The points that both of these physicians are making are absolutely correct. People should not be denied treatment for their suffering. The sole question that I'm raising is whether their depression has to be medicalized in order to be treated. And that's an important question.
Robert is calling from Buffalo, New York. Robert, hi, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm a nurse psychotherapist for longer than I'd like to remember. I have one question and then one observation. The question would be, what percentage of our population in general is on antidepressants at any given time?
What percentage of the population is on antidepressants? Dr. Jonathan Alpert from Mass General Hospital, could you answer that question?
I'm not aware of the answer to that. My guess would be somewhere around 5%, but I'm not certain what the current value is.
Dr. Alpert, great to have you with us. Thank you, sir.
It's a pleasure, Jane.
Yeah, I also read somewhere 20%, but when Prozac first came out, a patient said this to me, and over the years, it seems to be a variable, not the most important, but Prozac is a clean form of speed, and if you want to keep up with our society, you take antidepressants so you can keep up.
Robert, thank you for your call. I'd like to introduce another voice into our conversation. Joining us from Providence, Rhode Island, is Dr. Peter Kramer. He's a psychiatrist, a clinical professor of psychiatry and human behavior at Brown University, and author of Against Depression and Listening to Prozac. Dr. Kramer, welcome to you.
Hello, Jane. Good to discuss these important issues.
Thank you. I want to look at the broader questions, Dr. Kramer, that are embedded in Gary Greenberg's article, questions about depression and how we distinguish it from heartache, from the heartache of sort of normal life. But first, give me your reaction to the discussion that you've just heard about these clinical trials. Do you think trials are being conducted at research hospitals around the country? Are they a good idea? Are they amateurish, as Gary is describing?
Let me take two steps back. I think that the trials have their flaws. This whole diagnostic system, checklists and so on, has been extremely useful scientifically. It's given us insight into the genetics of depression. It's linked depression to things like heart disease and stroke. We have much more of a sense of how much a disease depression is, how destructive it is over a lifetime, early death, and so on, as a result of these checklists. On the other hand, in the individual case, these checklists are very inexact. People who have fewer symptoms go on to a terrible lifetime of suffering and suicide, and people who have more symptoms sometimes end up doing quite well. But I think Gary has mixed in with this, Greenberg, the problem of the pseudo-patient. Psychiatry has faced pseudo-patients for over 35 years. It was an early study, the Rosenhan study, you may know, where someone got a few people into hospitals based on saying they were hearing voices. And the problem with the pseudo-patient or pseudo-subject in this case has largely to do with severity. One of the diagnostic criteria for depression is that you have to be really disabled by the depression. And that turns out not to be a very important question for odd reasons, which is that when people come to see their doctor, they have severity. They're not doing well. So that you actually, in practice, it turns out you can eliminate this question of does this interfere with your living? Does this interfere with your raising your children? Are you suffering severely? Because people don't show up at clinics unless that's true. And it's about 97% of people meet severity criteria. Of course, pseudo-patients and pseudo-subjects like Gary Greenberg don't necessarily meet criteria for severity. On the other hand, they have another bias. They want to write an article. And bias is very subtle. You know, in science, we talk about research bias, and it doesn't mean that people are frankly dishonest. It means that because they want to get the study to come out right, they, without even knowing it, and he writes in his article a lot about the unconscious and placebos, people push things in a certain direction. So, you know, we don't know how good a witness he is when he says he shows up and was just frank about his troubles. Perhaps they were edged a little bit toward severity, whereas he doesn't actually have severity. So you get these odd results that result in, the kind of article that he's written for Harper's. But it's hard to know what's going on in terms of these studies, whether patients actually are being misdiagnosed.
Gary Greenberg, your motives for this study, you knew you were writing an article that perhaps because of that you pushed the facts in a certain direction. True, untrue?
Well, I can't say that's not true. I mean, I appreciate the sort of the way that Dr. Kramer puts it. He's not accusing me of bad faith, but I do want to distinguish between the Rosenhan study in which people actually went into emergency rooms and lied and said they were having symptoms that they weren't, and whatever happened with me at Mass General. In my experience, I was telling the truth, you know, full disclosure. But there's no question I was motivated. I'm very interested in this process. I've been writing about it for years. And when I was told that I didn't have minor depression, I was pretty disappointed because I thought I wasn't going to be able to participate in the trial. It was only when the doctor told me I had major depression that I discovered that I was going to get into a different trial. So I don't think there's any... I've got nothing to say about that except for that it is different from the Rosenhan study and that I wasn't simply making things up.
Kathy is calling from Lansing, Michigan. Kathy, hi. You're joining our conversation. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I'm on my cell phone, so I wasn't sure. I just wanted to say that, you know, I've had very similar reservations towards the diagnosis of depression. I have a social work degree and have worked with many different populations over the years. But my own experience was that I was totally against meds, and I was basically suicidal for 10 years. And, like, you know, every hour I was thinking about turning my car into a tree or, you know, what can I do to get out of this? And I totally believed that meds was just not the way to go. And I finally got to the point where I just could not function anymore. And I did go to my doctor, and I got meds, and I've been on them since September. And I feel like I've got my life back. And I'm so grateful that there are medications out there. And, you know, it's so I've kind of changed my whole perspective on this. But I do think that a lot of people are given meds, what, you know, and maybe they're not really having issues as much as they're kind of unhappy or whatever. But for those of us who really have serious issues, I'm just very grateful to have them.
Thank you, Kathy, for your call. I appreciate your thoughts. John is also calling from Chelmsford, Massachusetts. John, hello to you.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My daughter has been diagnosed twice with depression, and the doctor spent less than 15 minutes with her coming up with this diagnosis. Now, we've heard about the increase in suicides from antidepressants, so we managed to talk her out of taking them. But I'm concerned that our medical insurance is forcing the doctors to spend less time with the patients coming up with a diagnosis than is really needed.
John,
I think it's, what, 7 minutes per patient now? And if the doctors don't see enough patients, then the insurance companies get on the case?
Well, it brings us to another point, actually, about the antidepressants being a lot cheaper than talk therapy. And HMOs know that, don't they, Dr. Kramer?
Yes. I mean, this is scandalous. We know that the best treatment for depression is a combination of medication and psychotherapy. We know doctors need more time with their patients. And I would say that if this were cancer and we said, you know, the best treatment for you is chemotherapy and radiation, but we can't afford the radiation, so you won't have it, people would tear the insurance company buildings down brick by brick, and the same really should take place with depression. I wanted to get to this question of efficacy, actually, because I was surprised in Gary Greenberg's article that he didn't say almost the opposite of what he says. The problem with these drug company studies, and not I'm going to set Mass General aside, but the you know, the ones that are less well done, is precisely that people probably are admitted into the study that don't have the diagnosis. And the result is you get enormous placebo effects. You know, the people are under pressure to recruit subjects into the study. They take people who aren't that ill. Those people's conditions wax and wane. And you hide the drug effects. And the result is that these mass trials actually eliminate drugs that might be useful and minimize the effects of drugs. And you have this funny effect where you look at very serious conditions like post-stroke depression after people have had a cerebral infarction, they have a stroke, they have depression, and the medicine works. Or you look at a postpartum depression or chronic recurrent depression, and the medicine works very robustly. And then you look at sort of run-of-the-mill or minor depressions in these big drug company studies, and the medicine doesn't work as well. And I thought in his article he would say, having been through this sort of pseudo trial where he got a placebo of fish oil, he's all the more convinced that medicines must be more powerful than they're made out to be in these very imperfect trials.
Mm. Gary Greenberg, do you want to respond?
I think that's. I wish you'd been my editor, Peter, because that not that I didn't like my editor, but that's a really important point. I don't disagree with that at all. I think that to go back to the bias issue, perhaps I was biased and motivated to get into the study, but the study was motivated to get me into it.
Yeah.
For lots of different reasons. And I think that probably does account for the high placebo rates. My point in saying that there's a trouble distinguishing placebo from drug effect, that the signal-to-noise ratio is lower than we'd like it to be, is really just about – that's a critique of the way the trials are conducted, not of the drugs themselves. I think these drugs are modestly effective, but certainly effective. I think it's in my clinical experience, it's somewhat hit or miss. Unfortunately, in lots of the more severe cases, they don't work so well. But I think that's right. I think we just don't understand very well yet what they're doing, how they do it, who's will best benefit from which drug, and so on.
Well, I read a piece that said more than half of the clinical trials used to approve the 6 leading antidepressants, I think it was, the drugs failed to outperform the placebos in more than half of the clinical trials. What does that tell you, Dr. Kramer?
But these are very, very flawed trials, and you would think the drug companies would be smarter, but they're not. The drugs actually look better in the field and in these later, more complicated trials than they look in the sort of rushed trials to get the drug to market during the patent period. By the way, I do have an answer for your earlier caller. I just read the data on how many people have taken an antidepressant in the last year. And in 2002, between ages of 18 and 64, the sort of mid-range, about 10% of the population had taken an antidepressant at some time during the year. It's higher for the elderly and very low for children.
Mm. And that number's been pretty stable for a long time, you know, the 20 to 30 million range in any given year.
A call now from Charleston, South Carolina. Aubrey is on the line. Hello, Aubrey.
Hi. Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a fourth-year medical student about to graduate from medical school, so I've dealt with depression and depressed patients in my training. But I think for me, when I think about depression, I have a very dear friend, a college roommate, and the year after we graduated, she entered a very severe depression. And I was not living in the same city with her at the time, and it was talking on the phone. She was a completely different person. Her voice was soft. Her voice was quiet. She was not excited about anything. This is a person who loves life, who loved going outdoors, hiking. And she spent her time sitting in a dark room listening to music. And it just became very apparent to me that depression, you know, perhaps not all sadness should be medicalized, but I really believe that she had enough. And once she was treated, she got better. Now, 4 years later, you know, she's graduating from graduate school in Yale and doing extremely well, looking for jobs. You know, and I talked to her, and she's continued to do all the things that she loves instead of what she was doing at the time, which was almost nothing.
Aubrey, thanks for the call. Sometimes medication is absolutely needed, but Dr. Kramer and Gary Greenberg, is there a large portion of the public that somehow assumes that happiness is somehow a birthright, that if we're not happy all the time, that we need to change that? And a pill maybe is the answer.
Well, I don't know about all the time. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Peter.
No, I'm sorry, too. I'm going to say I don't see it. I'm sort of a lightning rod for stories about these medicines, and I really don't see these mildly afflicted people on medicine. And the same study that I mentioned that said 10% of the population is on antidepressants has a part that's not yet published that looked at severity, this issue of how ill are people who get prescribed. And doctors are not perfect, GPs and family doctors, in deciding who has what level of depression and so on. But it looks like they really don't medicate unless something is something, you know, may not be right that it's depression, but unless something is quite wrong. So I think these are cocktail party stories that people who are just taking medicines for happiness without something quite wrong with them. Gary, I mean, you probably...
Go ahead, Gary.
I'd say, I know I have a smaller practice than you do, Peter, but in my experience, there are many people who come to see me, since I can't prescribe meds, already medicated, who at least or get medicated shortly after because I refer them to a psychiatrist, who don't, you know, in my view, they probably don't meet the criteria, but I think that's true. I think the severity issue is poorly understood. At the same time, I think that people do feel better on these drugs without respect to their severity. In other words, they're drugs that can induce a state of well-being. You don't have to be depressed. I think it's possible that one of the reasons that more the statistics that Peter was talking about just earlier are accurate is because a lot of people who aren't terribly afflicted don't want to put up with the side effects of the drugs, particularly the sexual side effects. You know, people don't necessarily want to trade in their orgasms for being a little happier.
Martine is calling from Grand Island, Vermont. Martine, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Hi, Hi, thanks.
Sure.
Thanks for taking my call. I've enjoyed this conversation. I lost my dad about 13 years ago. He was murdered while on vacation. And it was obviously a tragedy for me and for my family. I've had very sad moments in my life and melancholy and so on. But I guess I just want to say that for some of us, sadness and melancholy is a part of life, and that getting through it on our own in our own way is a way to grow, and it really can enrich our lives in many ways and make us stronger. I did go on medication, and I'm glad I didn't. So I'll take any response off the air.
Martine, thank you very much.
Peter wrote an excellent book about this called Against Depression, so I'll let him answer that. But I did want to just say one thing about that, which is that I don't think that it's mutually exclusive to derive a meaning from your melancholy and to take drugs. But the chances of doing that are decreased if what you think going into the experience of taking the drugs is that you're curing an illness, as opposed to that you're finding a way to get through a difficult but probably meaningful and important passage in your life.
Peter Kramer?
Yes, I think it's very important to distinguish illness from non-illness. We're very much in agreement, and that's what listening to Prozac was about, which is that we have to watch out. These medicines probably can affect personality, and we want to be clear as a culture when we're treating disease and when we're doing something that I call cosmetic. But I do, in a way, disagree about the disease label. I think that in some ways it's very useful to be aware that something dangerous is going on, that you need to treat it very vigorously, if that's the case. And I think even in when we know what the cause is, this caller responded to a murder. She was bereaved. She was grieving. There's some evidence that these medicines, when given to people who are really laid low by bereavement, can affect their depressive symptoms and still allow them to grieve. That they're, that these same rating scales, they're grief rating scales, and the grief rating scales are affected very little, whereas these depressive symptoms in terms of worthlessness and guilty ruminations and so on diminish.
Let me ask you in our last couple of minutes here, do you think that the layman's definition of depression, the average American's definition of depression, is different from a professional's? And has that changed over the last few years? Dr. Kramer first.
I think we know depression when we see it, and the person who described this experience of really being laid low and having trouble moving, thinking poorly, being suicidal, it's very convincing that this is a disease. If you don't get to that next stage where you think, well, you're just worthless and nothing will help, but it's certainly convincing to the observer. I think we use the word very widely. It was a sort of a poor choice. Adolf Meyer made this choice of the word depression, which already had so many other uses in English, and we really need different vocabulary probably for the disease and, just the feeling of being, blue on a rainy day.
Gary Greenberg, last word from you.
I'm sorry. I was so thinking I got on a track about Adolf Meyer. What was the question again?
The layman's definition, the average American's definition of depression, do you think it's different? And has it changed over the years from a clinical definition, a professional definition of depression?
I think it's converging, the layman's and the clinical or the professional. I think they're converging, and I think they're converging on the side of the doctors. And I think that's just what happens because people's unhappiness and the way they think of it has been increasingly defined by medicine. I don't think that that's necessary, but I really want to make it clear. I agree that there are great advantages, both scientific and otherwise, to medicalizing it. It's just that we lose sight of the costs of medicalizing unhappiness.
I'd like to thank my guest this hour, Dr. Peter Kramer from Providence, Rhode Island. He's a clinical professor of psychiatry and human behavior at Brown University, author of Against Depression and Listening to Prozac. Dr. Kramer, great to have you on. Thank you for your perspectives.
Thank you.
And Gary Greenberg from Seattle, Washington, a psychotherapist and freelance writer, author of this essay in the May issue of Harper's Magazine called Manufacturing Depression. It's been great to have you on, Gary. Thank you for your work and your thoughts today.
Well, thank you, and I look forward to being back on the East Coast where I belong.
Thanks very much. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, have a great weekend. This is On Point.
Thank you.